Good morning. Welcome to the July 14, 2026 meeting of the Colorado River Basin Regional Quality Control Board. For everyone joining us in the meeting, please turn off or silence your phones. This meeting is being webcast and recorded, so please speak clearly. This meeting is being conducted in a physical location and is also available via remote access. For people who only want to listen or watch the meeting, the board's customary webcast is available. For those in the Zoom meeting, you will be muted with your camera off until your turn to speak. The host will then unmute you and ask you to turn on your camera if you have one. When you're done speaking, the board members completed asking questions, you will be placed on mute and your camera turned off. You can remain in the Zoom meeting until the completion of the item and then may choose to exit the meeting or continue. Okay. Board Member Gonzalez, please lead us the Pledge of Allegiance. Before we continue, I'd like to ask Madam Clerk to do roll call, please.
Chair Perez.
Here.
Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Good morning. Present.
Board Member Beltran.
Present.
Board Member Music.
Present.
Board Member Satin.
Present.
Board Member Wright.
Here.
Madam Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you. For the purpose of this public meeting, the regional board members to obtain testimony and information from concerned and affected parties within the Colorado Basin region regarding water quality issues. We welcome hearing from the public at this time. Any persons wishing to speak should have submitted a speaker request as described in the agenda instructions. For those items listed in today's agenda, you will make comments at the time the item is being considered. If you wish to speak on an item that is not on the agenda, you may speak now during the public forum. Comments will generally be limited to 3 minutes. The board clerk can now identify the speakers who have submitted speaker cards for the public forum.
There is no speakers.
Thank you. Item three. We now move to agenda item three, which is the review and approval of the minutes for the board's prior meeting on June 9th. Do we have a second?
Second.
Motion second individually. Hold, please.
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. For agenda item four, as Laurel Firestone has resigned her position with the State Water Board, we will not be hearing from the State Water Board's liaison update at today's meeting. We will certainly miss her. It was really nice getting to know her. The board will not consider items on the uncontested calendar. All items appearing under the uncontested items calendar are acted upon by one board motion without discussion. There are two items on today's uncontested calendar, agenda items 5 and 6. Item 5 is a waste discharge requirements order for drenched or filled discharges to waters of the state of the North Point Development LLC Sunset Crossroads Banning Project located in Riverside County. Item 6 is a waste discharge requirements order for drenched or filled discharges of waters of the state for the U.S. Gypsum Company Placer City Mine Expansion and Modernization Project located in Imperial County. Regarding the uncontested calendar, does any board member wish to remove this item from the uncontested calendar? If any member of the public wishes to remove the item from the uncontested calendar, you need to have filled out a speaker card. Madam Clerk, are there any speaker cards?
No, there is not.
Okay. And no board members? No? Okay, great. Can I get a motion on the uncontested item and a second?
I'll make a motion to approve items number 5 and 6 on the uncontested calendar.
I'll second the motion.
Thank you. Can I have roll call?
Chair Perez?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez?
Aye.
Board Member Beltran?
Aye.
Board Member Music?
Aye.
Board Member Satin?
Aye.
Board Member Wright?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. Proceeding now to the contested and discussion of calendar for items for adoption, there is one item on the contested calendar today. Agenda item 7, Waste Discharge Requirements Order Monitoring and Reporting Program for Clean Harbors Westmoreland LLC facility in Imperial County. I am now opening the hearing on agenda item 7, which is a Waste Discharge Requirements Order and Monitoring and Reporting Program for the Clean Harbors Westmoreland LLC facility in Imperial County. Madam Clerk, do we have any speaker cards on the agenda item?
No, we do not.
Thank you. Okay. I will now administer the oath to all persons intending to speak on this item. Raise your right hand and take the following oath. Do you swear or affirm that the testimony you are about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth under penalty of perjury? If so, say I do. Okay. Okay. Please state your name, affiliation, and whether you have taken the oath. Okay. The order of the speakers is presentation by Bradley Bowers. Board staff.
Good morning, Chair Perez, Vice Chair Gonzalez, and members of the board. My name is Bradley Bowers, and I am an engineering geologist in the Land Disposal Unit, and I have taken the oath. Today, I will be presenting on the tentative waste discharge requirements order for closure of the Clean Harbors Westmoreland Hazardous Waste Landfill, which is on the agenda today. Next slide, please. I will begin by providing an overview of the facility's location, history, and a brief description of the individual waste management units within the facility. Next, I will discuss the Water Board's authority and the regulatory framework under which this tentative order is being adopted. After that, I will highlight some of the post-closure maintenance and monitoring requirements for the facility included in the tentative order. And finally, I will provide a summary of the public comments we received as well as the staff responses to those comments. Next slide, please. The image on the left shows the regional location of the Clean Harbors Westmoreland facility. It is located south of the Salton Sea and west of Westmoreland and Brawley. The facility is on the west side of Highway 78 in Imperial County. The facility is owned and operated by Clean Harbors Westmoreland LLC, who is the named discharger on the tentative order. To my knowledge, there are only 3 hazardous waste landfill facilities currently in California, including this facility. This is the only one in Region 7 and the first one to close statewide since the 1980s. On the right side is a satellite image where you can see the facility's property boundaries and area of historic operations. The portion of the facility we are focusing on for the tentative order is outlined in orange. The facility is located on uncultivated, unirrigated desert land, and it is bordered on all sides by public lands managed by BLM. There are no residential areas, industrial facilities, schools, or hospitals within a 1-mile radius of the facility. On the next slide, I will identify the individual waste management units within the facility, which are subject to the tentative order. Next slide, please. In this image, you can see the general boundaries of each of the 4 landfill-type waste management units within the facility. Of those 4 units, 3 are Class 1 units containing hazardous waste, and 1 is a Class 2 unit, which contains non-hazardous waste. For the Class 1 hazardous waste units outlined in orange, Unit 1 received waste from 1988 until 1991. Unit LC2 received waste from 1990 until 2020, and LC3 from 1989 until 1995. The Morton Solids unit, outlined in blue, received non-hazardous Class 2 geothermal solid waste from 1983 until 1988. As I will explain in detail on the next slide, the California Department of Toxic Substances Control, or DTSC, has primary oversight responsibilities for the hazardous waste units at this facility, and the Regional Water Board has primary oversight responsibilities for the non-hazardous Class II Morton Solids Unit. The existing board order was adopted in 1994. It describes Unit LC1 as being closed, but this order was issued prior to the closure of Units LC2 and LC3. The order does not include the closure of the Morton Solids Unit. However, all records indicate that this unit was closed and capped in 1988 by a previous discharger. The tentative order on the agenda today updates the descriptions for all units as now being closed, and it prescribes post-closure maintenance and monitoring requirements for both Class 1 and the Class 2 unit. Next slide, please. The Class 1 hazardous waste units at this facility are regulated under California Code of Regulations Title 23, while the non-hazardous Class 2 Morton Solids unit is regulated under Title 27. In 1993, Senate Bill 1082 was passed, which required either DTSC or the Regional Water Board to be designated as the agency with primary oversight responsibilities for Class 1 hazardous waste management units. A joint memo was released soon thereafter by DTSC and the State Water Board, which gave primary oversight responsibility for this facility to DTSC. This memo is included in the tentative order as Attachment C. DTSC issued their post-closure permit for the hazardous waste units in August 2025, and the tentative order on the agenda today prescribes the Water Board's post-closure requirements for all units within the facility. Specifically, it includes provisions for the hazardous waste units, which align with DTSC's permit requirements that were already issued, and it also includes requirements for the non-hazardous Morton Solids unit, for which the Regional Water Board has primary oversight responsibility. Next slide, please. Both Title 23 and Title 27 prescribe requirements for post-closure maintenance and monitoring. Some of the requirements in the tentative order that I would like to highlight today are for the discharger to monitor and sample groundwater via monitoring wells, to monitor and sample leachate collection and removal systems, to monitor the moisture content of soils in the unsaturated vadose zone, to inspect and maintain the integrity of the landfill cover systems, and to provide financial assurances to cover the costs of these activities throughout the post-closure period. The combination of these monitoring systems is intended to prevent the contamination of groundwater, provide for early detection of a release from the units, and ultimately to maintain groundwater quality in our region. I'll briefly describe each of these systems on the next few slides. Next slide, please. Groundwater monitoring occurs via wells, which are placed around the perimeter of each unit. In this area, groundwater generally flows towards the northeast, as shown with the blue arrow on the bottom left side of this image. The wells for each unit in the image are color-coded with the unit names on the slide for easy reference. Blue for unit LC1 in the upper right, green for LC2 on the upper left, red for LC3 in the lower center, and pink for Morton Solids in the upper middle. The natural background water chemistry is monitored via up-gradient monitoring wells, indicated by the triangles in this image, while detection monitoring wells are used to detect any changes down-gradient from the units, which could indicate a release. The detection wells are indicated by circles in this image. Groundwater monitoring data has been collected for each unit since construction, and to date, no releases have occurred. The tentative order allows for the removal of some groundwater wells to eliminate redundant sampling points, and it allows for the redesignation of some wells to better characterize groundwater chemistry. The wells that will change have a red square around them in this image. One example of this can be seen near the upper center of the image at MW36, shown in pink, which is beneath the words water pond and to the left of the Morton Solids unit. Due to the natural flow direction of groundwater, MW36 is proposed to be redesignated from a detection well for Morton Solids unit to a background well for both Morton Solids and unit LC1. After the proposed changes, the number of wells assigned to each unit are shown on this slide, and are also included in Attachment B4 of the Tentative Monitoring and Reporting Program. The tentative order requires sampling and lab analyses twice per year for a minimum of 5 years after adoption. And if there are if there is no confirmation of a release in that time, the monitoring frequency will then be reduced to an annual schedule. If a release does occur, the monitoring frequency will revert to semi-annually. Next slide, please. Each Class 1 unit was constructed with a double liner system, which includes both primary and secondary leachate collection and removal, or LCRS, systems. Leachate is liquid, which has contacted waste within the unit. The general intent of an LCRS system is to provide a permeable drainage layer beneath the waste, which allows the discharger to collect and remove any liquid which has drained from that waste. Beneath the permeable drainage layer, there is a low permeability liner layer to prevent the downward migration of liquids. A double line system, like the one you see here, also has a secondary drainage system intended to capture any liquids which leak through the primary liner. As shown in the image on the left, starting from the waste at the bottom of the landfill, the system starts with a compacted soil layer, soil cover layer at the top to prevent waste from damaging the LCRS. Beneath that soil, the primary LCRS drainage layer collects leachate. The LCRS is built with a slight slope, allowing leachate to collect into a drainage sump where it is pumped out and sampled. And you can see an access pipe for the LCRS system in the photo at the bottom right. Underneath the primary LCRS drainage layer lies a relatively impermeable HDPE liner, which prevents leachate from infiltrating down through that primary LCRS. In a double line system, beneath that primary LCRS and HDPE liner, there is a second system consisting of another permeable LCRS drainage layer followed by another impermeable HDPE liner. And that second LCRS system and liner are then underlain by 3 feet of low permeability compacted clay and finally natural soils. The LCRS systems will be monitored monthly for at least 2 months after adoption. If there is no leachate present in both months, the monitoring frequency will reduce to quarterly. If after 2 consecutive quarters there is still no leachate present, the monitoring frequency will be reduced to a semi-annual schedule. And it should be noted that no leachate has been detected in the secondary LCRS systems for either LC1 or LC3 since they were closed in 1991 and 1995, respectively. All LCRS systems will be tested annually to ensure they are working properly. Next slide, please. Each Class 1 unit was constructed with multiple neutron probe tubes or access points extending beneath it. A neutron probe measures the moisture content of soil in the unsaturated zone, which is also called the vadose zone, which is the underground area between the bottom of the landfill liner system and the top of the groundwater table. A vadose zone monitoring system is intended to identify liquid releases from the waste units by detecting changes in soil moisture in the ground beneath those units. During the post-closure maintenance and monitoring period, one access point per Class 1 unit will remain active, as shown in red on these images. At least 2 readings will be taken at different depths per access point during each monitoring event. The vadose zone will be monitored quarterly for at least the first year after adoption. If no changes in soil moisture greater than 5% occur, the monitoring frequency will reduce to semi-annually for at least 1 year. If again, any soil moisture changes remain lower than 5%, the frequency will then reduce to an annual schedule. If at any point changes greater than 10% are found, monitoring will revert to quarterly. And please note the final bullet on this slide at the bottom should read 10%. Next slide, please. Each unit has had its final cover system installed, with unit LC2 being the most recently constructed. The 2 photos you see here are from the top of unit LC2, taken during an inspection I performed in November of 2025. The photo on the upper right shows the compacted top deck of the cover, which is sloped to promote drainage. And around the perimeter of the top deck, there is a berm which collects and channels runoff water into a plastic drain pipe, which then conveys it downslope and away from the unit. You can see the inlet of the drain pipe in the photo at the bottom left. The cover systems are designed to both contain the waste and also to prevent rainwater from infiltrating down into the waste unit, eventually creating leachate. To achieve this, the cover systems were built with the following components from top to bottom. The top deck soil cover, which again is sloped to promote drainage and compacted to prevent erosion. A geotextile fabric layer to stabilize the top deck soil layer. Beneath that, an impermeable HDPE liner to prevent water from infiltrating down into the waste. An impermeable clay layer to do the same thing. And finally, a layer of compacted waste and native soils to provide a foundation for the cover system above it. Visual inspections of each unit's cover system will occur monthly throughout the post-closure period. And importantly, groundwater monitoring, the LCRS systems, vadozone probes, and the covers I described are not the only components of the complete monitoring strategy for the facility. I highlighted these for informational purposes, but there are other inspections and monitoring requirements as outlined in the tentative order and its monitoring and reporting program. Next slide, please. Title 23 requires the discharger to maintain financial assurances for closure, post-closure maintenance, and responses to release corrective actions for the Class 1 hazardous waste units. Title 27 requires the same for the Class 2 non-hazardous Morton Solids unit. The general procedure for this is for dischargers to prepare an estimate of the costs of maintenance, permit compliance, and release response actions, which could occur throughout the post-closure period, and then submit that estimate for staff review and executive officer approval. The approved estimate is then used to obtain a financial assurance instrument, which is typically a bond, which establishes an irrevocable fund for these activities. Estimates and assurances are typically updated annually to account for inflation and cost fluctuations. The current order did not specifically require the discharger to submit financial assurance documentation for the Class 2 Morton Solids unit. The tentative order does require the discharger to prepare a cost estimate for the post-closure maintenance and monitoring of the Morton Solids unit within 90 days of adoption to obtain an appropriate financial assurance mechanism by December 31st of this year, and then to provide annual updates thereafter. Next slide, please. The tentative order was distributed to interested parties for public review and comment from June 1st to July 1st, 2026. During that time, staff received written comments only from the discharger. The discharger's comments included two main requests for clarification within the tentative order. First, the discharger asked to clarify that the concentration limits for volatile organic compounds, or VOCs, should only be non-detect for groundwater, not non-detect for both groundwater and landfill gases. Staff concurs that based on the historic groundwater data, there should not be measurable amounts of VOCs in the groundwater, and therefore the concentration limit for VOCs in groundwater should be non-detect. The concentration limits for organic VOCs in landfill gases, however, have not yet been determined due to a lack of available background data. Gas probes were installed in April 2026 at the direction of DTSC, and the discharger will propose concentration limits for organic VOCs in landfill gases separately when more data becomes available. These concentration limits will be proposed by the discharger and approved by DTSC in consultation with the Regional Water Board. Excuse me. Staff concur with this clarification, and the tentative order has been revised accordingly. In their second comment, the discharger requested clarification about the timing of changes in monitoring frequencies if an exceedance is measured in groundwater. Specifically, they asked if the monitoring frequencies for all components of the monitoring system, such as the groundwater wells, the LCRS, the vadozone probes, will automatically revert to their initial post-adoption frequencies immediately when one lab result exceeds a concentration limit, or if the discharger would have the opportunity to perform retesting and confirm if that exceedance is actually evidence of a release, or if it was a false positive caused by natural fluctuations in groundwater chemistry, or a sampling or laboratory error. Staff concur. Both Title 23 and Title 27 provide procedures for the discharger to follow when an exceedance occurs during monitoring. These include notifying the Regional Water Board of the exceedance, performing resampling and retesting within 30 days, and then providing a technical report which confirms if that exceedance is evidence of a release or if it was a false positive. The tentative order has been revised to clarify the retest procedure and make clear that sampling events will revert to their initial post-adoption frequencies after a release is confirmed, not immediately when an exceedance is first measured. Next slide, please. The tentative order has been distributed to board members and interested parties and includes all changes and responses to comments included in this presentation. Staff's recommendation is to adopt the revised tentative order for closure of the Clean Harbors Westmoreland facility. Next slide, please. And thank you for your time. That concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you.
Good morning. Thank you for a nice presentation. Is this a secure facility? Is it surrounded by a fence, or is there someone there all the time?
Yes, it is. So it is surrounded by a fence. The gate is locked. It's not open to the public. And my understanding is they will have staff there during working hours. I don't know if there's someone there 24 hours a day, but.
And you talked about water flow from to the northeast. What's the source, and do we know what the annual, is that natural recharge, what the amount of water that's flowing through there annually?
I don't know that offhand. The source, it's groundwater basically flowing towards the axis of the valley, the Salton Sea. Everything flows towards the Salton Sea. So where that recharge is coming from specifically would assume be on a regional scale, just natural infiltration. And they do produce velocities of groundwater, but I don't think we know the volume of groundwater that's moving beneath the facility.
Okay, and then monthly viewing, who enforces that? The regional board?
I'm sorry,
monthly? You said the facility had to be, was going to be viewed monthly to make sure everything's okay. Do they submit a report to the regional board for that?
Absolutely. So the monthly inspections of the cover systems are performed by the discharger and then submitted to us in annual reports, I believe. And then we verify, and we also perform our own typically annual inspections.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional comments or questions? Thank you. Okay, may I have a motion for agenda item 7,
which so is... So moved.
Okay. Second.
May I have a roll call vote?
Chair Perez.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gonzalez.
Aye.
Board Member Beltran.
Aye.
Board Member Music.
Aye.
Board Member Satin.
Aye.
Board Member Wright.
Aye.
Motion carries.
Thank you. We're now moving to items 8 and 12. Item 8 is Irrigated Land Expert Panel Update. The board will now hear a presentation update. The board on the progress of the Irrigated Land Expert Panel. Regional Board Staff Member Ryan Holhane will be presenting this item. This is informational only, no action to be taken. I thank you.
Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board. I'm Ryan Holhane, Staff Environmental Scientist here at the Colorado River Basin Regional Water Board. I'll be presenting information on the Agricultural Expert Panel Report recently presented to the State Board. Next. Today I'll be discussing the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program Background, ILRP, how Ag Expert Panels have been part of that ILRP process, some of the Ag Expert Panel recommendations to the State Board on June 16th, and how this process may affect Region 7 Ag Program. With over 400,000 commodities statewide, California landscapes are diverse, calling for varying regulations. The ILRP is a statewide program overseen by the State Water Resources Control Board and regional water boards. Each of the 9 regional water boards adopts their own waste discharge requirements, WDRs, to address regional needs for water quality protection. Although each region adopts their own WDRs, there are statewide precedential requirements. The first agricultural expert panel recommendations guided the statewide ag regulatory program and were the basis for statewide precedential requirements. Overall, the first panel recommended the use of nitrogen applied or A, nitrogen removed or R, and the A over R ratio as the primary metric for evaluating progress on source control, with eventual impact on groundwater quality. They suggested that all growers develop and implement irrigation and nitrogen management plans. They advised that individual farm data be aggregated by third-party coalitions. The panel also recommended that nitrogen targets should be used for education and benchmarking rather than regulatory limits. After concluding that there was insufficient data and scientific knowledge to set limits, many of the requirements that have been included and used to inform the Eastern San Joaquin, or ESJ, Ag Order in Region 5 originated from the first agricultural panel in 2014. Our Ag General Order was developed using the ESJ as a framework. The orders listed here were used to develop charge questions for a second agricultural expert panel, which will be discussed later in the presentation, and they are key to understanding the current ILRP. The State Water Board's Eastern San Joaquin, or ESJ, order, which had been considered precedential, followed later by the State Water Board's Central Coast Agricultural Order, which had been challenged using the ESJ precedential requirements. In 2018, the State Water Board adopted the ESJ order in response to petitions filed against an order issued by the Central Valley Water Board to the Eastern San Joaquin Coalition. The order issued by the State Water Board included now established statewide precedential requirements. All regions were allotted 5 years to include these precedential requirements in their regional orders. Precedential requirements include, but are not limited to, outreach and education, groundwater quality monitoring, and irrigation and nitrogen management plans. Next slide. The Central Coast Ag Order was adopted in 2023 by the State Board. This order was adopted in response to petitions filed against their Ag Order 4.0, which had been issued by the Central Coast Regional Board in 2021. In the Central Coast Agricultural Order, the State Water Board remanded provisions of Ag Order 4.0, specifically reversing the region's order requirements for enforceable nitrogen discharge and fertilizer application limits, as well as credits, as they went beyond the precedential requirements of the ESJ order. This table shows the status of the agricultural orders across the state to give an idea of where all the regions are in their ILRP development. Each region began implementing at different times. Regions 3 and 5 have been implementing their ILRP for over 23 years, while in contrast, Region 1 adopted their first ILRP order last year. Region 7 orders were completed over 3 years. From 2019 to 2021, the orders cover different areas in our region, but utilize the same framework. Currently, all but 2 regions have incorporated the ESJ precedential requirements into their orders. Region 2 has their vineyard order, which does not use the precedential requirements, and Region 9 has not updated their precedential requirements for either their third-party coalition or their individually enrolled growers. This map shows the agricultural areas in our region in green. There are four orders authorizing coalitions to represent the main agricultural areas of our region. The largest area is Imperial Valley, which covers about 450,000 acres of agricultural land at the south end of the Salton Sea, but our region has over 150,000 acres covered by three other coalitions with very different challenges. Coachella Valley, at the north end of the Salton Sea, Palo Verde and Bard are on the margins of the Colorado River on the right-hand side of the slide. The next few slides will walk us through an overview of the panel process. It began in response to a commitment that the State Water Board made in both the ESJ and Central Coast Agricultural Orders with the intention of convening the panel in the future to determine if there was enough data and available science to establish nitrogen limits. In support of that commitment, State Board and Regional Board staff conducted a data analysis of available irrigation and nitrogen management plan summary report data and determined that although there were data limitations, a panel would be crucial for program development. This second ag expert panel came from that determination. The next step of the process included development of panel charge questions, which were developed with public engagement and resulted in 9 questions that essentially ask our panel to evaluate whether current nitrogen data is scientifically sufficient to define regulatory limits and provide expert advice to the California Irrigated Lands Regulatory Programs. Finally, State Board staff identified the panel members. This input from regional water boards, non-governmental organizations, agricultural industry experts, and other interested parties to identify a group of individuals that could provide balanced consideration on the panel charge questions. This slide helps highlight the schedule and engagement that was included in the panel process. Panel meeting started in August 2025. The overall panel process included 3 major meeting types, including plenary meetings, which were all-day events to present critical information to the assembled experts, public listening sessions to solicit feedback from all the interested parties, and working group meetings to facilitate small discussion sessions for panel members to discuss on topical issues relevant to the development of its recommendations. In total, there were 4 plenary meetings, 2 listening sessions, and 14 working group meetings. The draft panel report was released for public comment in March of 2026. The input received was captured and shared with panel members for their consideration, and they thoughtfully addressed many comments and then finalized the report on June 5th. In total, including the State Board staff-led workshop, 21 meetings were held to support the panel process. The Agricultural Expert Panel presented the final recommendations to the State Board in a public meeting on June 16th. Next slide. There was significant engagement throughout the process, and Region 7 staff attended every meeting held. There were an average of 80 attendees attending the various panel meetings regularly, and at one point more than 100 attendees were present. This included over 60 presentations given either by invitation or as extended comments and were received from regional water boards, interested parties, and scientific experts, all available for reference through the meeting recordings on the expert panel webpage. Region 7 staff presented, commented at multiple meetings, and sent an extended comment. Growers from our region also participated with presentations, and several comments were submitted from growers in our area. The final report was approved by the panel on June 5th. It is currently being formatted and will be available on the expert panel website listed here by the end of July. This report was presented to the State Board June 16th by State Board staff and panel chair Dr. Geisler. The following slides are pulled from Dr. Geisler's explanation to the State Board. His entire presentation is available on the State Board site. We have added only 5 of over 30 slides he presented. We encourage you to listen to his explanation if you want a deeper walkthrough of the report. However, a lot of the charge questions and explanations do focus on Regions 3 and 5. The upcoming green slides are from Dr. Geisler's presentation, but the explanation of the slides comes from our regional staff. Nitrogen calculations were a core concept covered by the expert panel. In this slide, it shows the A and R values and how they can be used to track nitrogen. The changes recommended, however, are not likely to have a large impact on our region immediately because we already have this requirement in our orders, and panel recommendations must go through state board process before being considered for adoption. Our region also does not have the crop-specific research to allow some of the deeper discussion points to immediately impact us. Next slide. Another important section that the expert panel agreed on was the need for an alternative reporting system for small and diversified farms. This may be important in our region, allowing smaller-scale growers a simplified reporting process. The potentially most impactful section that the expert panel discussed was called Other Alternative Reporting Candidates. The commodities that they would likely be important for us to monitor would be alfalfa, non-fertilized pasture, and our basin would likely fall into what would be considered unique conditions. The panel finds several cropping systems to be potential candidates for some form of exception or alternative compliance pathways, but further research and assessment is needed to develop more specific recommendations. They specifically mention wine grape vineyards, alfalfa, clover pasture, nursery, and floral industry, and some organic and regenerative farms and farming practices. These alternative reporting procedures are still being discussed. It is important to note this is only the recommendation phase. As we'll discuss later, the State Board plans to have several more discussions on these procedures and what that would entail. The expert panel came to the consensus that regulatory actions in our program may not be enough to reach our goals on their own. The panel believes that outreach to farmers, increased technical assistance from the regions along with other subject matter experts, and more research is needed. They called this their all-hands-on-deck approach and found it important to implement the ILRP. The expert panel had this slide as their summary of recommendations. The difference of targets and limits were key in the discussion throughout the process. The A-R nitrogen approach remains their top recommendation to update reporting, which is different to the A-over-R approach. The key difference is that the numbers are compared directly, nitrogen applied minus nitrogen removed, with A minus R, instead of comparing to other growers, which was the focus of A over R. The panel does think that both uses of the numbers are important, and the difference is only in how we calculate data. The data collected will remain the same. The multi-year focus is new from the expert panel, but something that has been in place in our region for some time. The conclusions made by State Board around alternative reporting will likely be the most impactful to our region. The expert panel presentation to the State Board was the final step in the panel process. And now staff will transition from a supportive role to an active role to support continuous improvement of the ILRP. The State Board and Regional Water Boards will review and begin implementation of the panel recommendations. So, with that in mind, this is a list of actions that the State Board recommended regional boards could begin to undertake. The first few items can be done in parallel. These include tightening up implementation of the current program, such as improving data reporting and closing gaps in the reporting structure, review the final report data to identify other recommendations that can be implemented immediately, and Regional Water Board staff will be asked to present to the State Board their perspectives on the recommendations and how those should be considered with respect to regional flexibility versus the need for statewide consistency. Following these initial efforts, the next step would be to engage with all interested parties in a broader venue to develop and eventually propose to the State Board options for addressing recommendations that require regulatory action. As a reminder, we'll continue to be held to the precedential requirements until they are changed by the State Board. Once those orders have been updated, we may be able to update our region's orders to reflect those changes. This will take time, as the State Board will be soliciting input from all regional ILRPs before updating the precedential requirements. Staff at Region 7 will continue to contribute to the process with the State Board and will ensure our region stays an important part of ILRP recommendations. Implementing most of the recommendations will take time and collaboration with coalitions. The regional water boards will need additional resources, including more staff, to effectively incorporate these changes. Slide. This concludes my presentation. Thank you. I'm available for any questions if needed.
Thank you.
The participants from our region, did they include the coalitions or were they all individual farmers?
So a little of both. We did have one of the coalitions present for our region for one of them. Individual growers did take it upon themselves to also include both comments written and in the working group sessions.
But the coalitions did provide their generalized comments to as
absolutely.
Well?
Absolutely. Okay, they were in each of the meetings with us.
Thank you.
In your slide, in a nutshell, you mentioned consider alternative reporting for certain farm types. You mentioned crops and cropping systems. What's the difference?
You know, that's a fair question. systems would be more how you're doing it, whereas crops would be what you're actually growing.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For agenda item 9, board staff Andrea Varela and Fatima Arahim have prepared a waste water study session information item regarding the regulations of facilities which discharge wastewater to surface waters or to land. Our assistant executive officer, Kai Dunn, will be introducing this item. Again, no action will be taken.
Good morning, Chair Press, member of the board, and a member of the public. I'm Kai Dunn, assistant executive officer for Region 7. Today, I would like to introduce Region 7 wastewater program. Next. Okay. The treated or domestic wastewater is regulated based on discharge location. Surface water falls under NPDES program, while the land discharge is managed by the WDR program. Fatima Arahan handles NPDES, and Andrea Varela oversees WDR. They will provide an overview for both program and the permitting requirement. Next. This slide shows the wastewater plant location in Region 7. There are 17 green pins marked NPDES site, and the 36 blue pins indicate WDR facility. And next, I would like to introduce Fatima to provide an overview for NPDES wastewater program.
Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, and members of the public. My name is Fatima Al-Rahim. I am a water resource control engineer in the National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES unit. In this presentation, I will provide information that's relevant to the treated wastewater discharges to surface water, which are regulated by National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, or NPDES, federal regulations. Next slide, please. Next slide. Thanks. There are five major surface waters within Region 7, including Colorado River, Alamo River, New River, Salton Sea, and Coachella Valley Stormwater Channel, also known as the White Water River, as shown on the map in green boxes. Next slide, please. The NPDES permit serves as both a National Pollutant Discharge Elimination System, NPDES permit, for waste discharges subject to the Federal Clean Water Act and implementing regulation adopted by the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, U.S. EPA. And as a waste discharge requirements, WDRs, for discharges subject to the California Clean Water Act. To the California Water Code. The NPDES permit authorizes point source discharges into surface waters as federal jurisdictions for waters of the United States at a specific discharge location. Next slide, please. The NPDES permit implements and incorporates state and federal laws and regulations, policies, and plans, including but not limited to the Water Quality Control Plan for the Colorado River Basin Region. Basin Plan designates beneficial uses, establishes water quality objectives, and contains implementation programs and policies to achieve those objectives for all waters addressed through the plan. The California Toxics Rule, CTR, promulgated new toxics criteria for California and, in addition, incorporated the previously adopted National Toxics Rule, NTR, criteria that were applicable in the state. These rules contain federal water quality criteria for priority pollutants. The NPDES permit does not authorize any act that results in the taking of threatened or endangered species or any act that's now prohibited or becomes prohibited in the future under either the California Endangered Species Act or the Federal Endangered Species Act. The anti-degradation policy requires that existing water quality of high-quality waters be maintained unless degradation is justified based on specific findings. The anti-backsliding provisions require that affluent limitations in a reissued permit must be as stringent as those in the previous permit, with some exception in which limitations may be relaxed. The statewide bacteria provisions establish E. coli as the sole indicator of pathogens in freshwater. These numeric water quality objectives are already effective statewide, and they have been incorporated into the basin plan. The statewide toxicity provisions establish a uniform regulatory approach to provide consistent protection of aquatic life, beneficial uses, and protect aquatic habitat and life from the effects of known and unknown toxicants. Next slide, please. The Water Quality Control Plan, referred to as the Basin Plan, is the central regulatory document for ensuring water quality in the Colorado River Basin region. The Basin Plan contains beneficial uses, water quality objectives to protect the beneficial uses, implementation agreements, monitoring plans, and other policies in effect. Next slide, please. Water quality objectives, as defined in the Water Code Division 7, are limits or levels of water quality constituents or characteristics which are established for the reasonable protection of beneficial uses of water or the prevention of nuisance within a specific area. Water quality objectives are designed to be in accordance with all pertinent state and federal requirements. Next slide, please. The requirements in the NPDES permit implements the basin plan and protect existing and potential beneficial uses of the receiving water. The water quality objectives are determined by beneficial uses. Beneficial uses are designated according to the typical use of a water and can include activities that are not recommended but still occur. All existing and potential uses must be designated. The beneficial uses designated for surface water with the most protective water quality objectives are those that protect human health, such as water contact recreation, REC 1, and non-contact water recreation, REC 2, and those that protect aquatic life, such as warm freshwater habitat, WARM, wildlife habitat, WILD, and preservation of rare, threatened, or endangered species, rare. Next slide, please. There are 17 NPDES wastewater treatment facilities in Region 7, and 15 of these facilities are publicly owned treatment works, POTW facilities, as shown by the map. Next slide, please. The wastewater treatment consists of preliminary treatment, which include bar screens and grid removal chamber, primary treatment, which include primary clarifiers, secondary treatment, which include aeration basins and secondary clarifiers, tertiary treatment, which include chlorination, dechlorination chamber, or UV disinfection. There are more details to the wastewater treatment process, which will be covered by my colleague, Andrea. Next slide, please. As you can see in the picture shown, in number one, the influent enters the main influent pumping station and is screened through mechanical bar screens. In number two, screened influent is directed to the grid removal chamber and then to the primary clarifier as shown by number three. In number four, flow is then directed to the aeration basins, then to the secondary clarifiers in number five, and then to the chlorination-dechlorination chamber in number six. In numbers 7 and 8, treated wastewater is discharged from the discharge point to surface water. The accumulated sludge from the primary and secondary stages is piped into sludge digesters for further breakdown of the material. The sludge is then pumped to a belt press for dewatering, as shown by the unnumbered stations in the picture. Dewatered solids are placed on drying beds for further moisture reduction. Biosolids are then removed from the wastewater treatment facility site for disposal. Next slide, please. The wastewater treatment plant must, at a minimum, meet applicable technology-based requirements and any more stringent effluent limitations necessary to meet applicable water quality standards. The technology-based requirements consist of secondary treatment standards where the regulation allow limitations for facilities using aeration basins that meet the treatment process type requirements for secondary treatment, and equivalent to secondary standards where the regulation allow alternative limitations for facilities using trickling filters or waste stabilization ponds that meet the treatment process type requirements for equivalent to secondary treatment. Next slide, please. The technology-based effluent limitations are divided into categories. Limitation for secondary treatment standard, which allow biochemical oxygen demand, BOD, and total suspended solids, TSS, concentrations of up to 30 mg per liter, for monthly average data, and the removal efficiency must be kept above 85%, where the pH range for the effluent must be maintained within 6 to 9, and limitation for equivalent to secondary treatment standards, which allow effluent limitations that are less stringent than secondary treatment standards. However, as technology advances and when it is feasible, more wastewater treatment facilities will move towards secondary treatment standards. Next slide, please. The NPDES permit monitoring requirements consist of effluent monitoring, where the discharger is required to conduct monitoring of the permitted discharges, receiving water monitoring, where surface water monitoring is required to characterize the water quality of the receiving water, constituents of concern, which include conventional pollutants, non-conventional pollutants, and toxic pollutants, and self-monitoring reports, SMRs, where the discharger is required to submit values in ESMR to determine compliance with the permit effluent limit requirements in the CUX program. Next slide, please. Monitoring for conventional pollutants, such as biochemical oxygen demand, BOD, total suspended solids, TSS, bacteria, oil and grease, and pH, and non-conventional pollutants, such as chlorine, ammonia, nitrogen, phosphorus, chemical oxygen demand, COD, and whole effluent toxicity, WET, and toxic pollutants, such as the 126 priority pollutants, is required to control all pollutants which are or may be discharged at a level which will cause, have the reasonable potential to cause or contribute to an excursion above any state water quality standard. Next slide, please. Federal regulations limit the duration of NPDES permit to a fixed term, not to exceed 5 years. Ideally, NPDES permits need to be renewed every 5 years. However, an expired permit is automatically continued pending the reissuance of the new permit. Time required for staff to prepare an NPDES permit is more than 4 months in a normal renewal. Now I will introduce my colleague Andrea to talk about discharge permits that affect groundwater. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, and members of the public. My name is Andrea Varela. I'm a water resource control engineer and staff of the land disposal unit. In this presentation, I will provide an overview of treated wastewater discharges that are regulated by the land disposal unit here in Region 7. I will provide general information that summarizes the types of discharges that staff regularly evaluates when managing facilities and monitoring and developing waste discharge requirements, or WDRs, for the protection of groundwater. The discharge to land program is different from the NPDES program that Fatima just presented, in that it regulates the discharge of treated wastewater to land facilities, where the NPDES regulates discharges to surface waters. These land facilities, in some cases, preclude infiltration or percolation to groundwater. In some cases, some facilities have lined surface impoundments for evaporation of wastewater only. The Regional Water Board is granted authority by the Porter-Cologne Water Quality Control Act, which is contained in Division 7 of the California Water Code. The Act establishes the 9 regional water boards and the state water board as the principal state agencies with primary responsibility and authority for control of water quality. Under this authority, the land disposal unit conducts permit activities, including issuing and renewing permits, conducting inspections, reviewing monitoring reports, and taking enforcement action against dischargers who fail to comply. The Water Quality Control Plan for the Colorado River Basin Region, or Basin Plan, states that Regional Water Board's goal is to maintain the existing quality, water quality of all non-degradable groundwater basins. However, in most cases, groundwater pumped generally returns to the basin after use with an increase in mineral concentration and total dissolved solids, or TDS, and nitrates. Under these circumstances, the Regional Water Board's objective is to minimize the quantities of contaminants reaching any groundwater basin. The discharge of wastewater from a facility should reflect best practicable treatment or control, or BPTC. The controls ensure the discharge does not create a condition of pollution or nuisance, and that water quality will be maintained, which is consistent with the anti-degradation provisions of State Water Resources Control Board Resolution 6816, policy with respect to maintaining high-quality waters of the state. The beneficial uses of groundwater in the Colorado River Basin include municipal and domestic supply, agriculture supply, industrial supply, service supply. Municipal and domestic supply includes uses of water for community, military, or individual water supply systems, including but not limited to drinking water supply. Agriculture supply includes uses of water for farming, horticulture, or ranching, including but not limited to irrigation, stock watering, or supportive vegetation or range grazing. Industrial service supply includes uses of water for industrial activities and do not depend primarily on water quality, including but not limited to mining, cooling water supply, hydraulic conveyance, gravel washing, fire protection, and oil well repressurization. Beneficial uses are a controlling factor in establishing water quality objectives. With respect to groundwater quality objectives, groundwater of all the Regional Water Board's goal is to maintain the existing water quality of all non-degraded groundwater basins and to minimize the quantities of contaminants reaching any groundwater basin. Some constituents of concern include biochemical oxygen demand, which is the most widely used parameter to measure gross amounts of organic matter in wastewater. The determination of BOD in wastewater involves the measurement of dissolved oxygen used by microorganisms in biochemical oxidation of organic matter. Excessive BOD loading in disposal to land applications may result in nuisance odors or anaerobic conditions, which are not favorable biological treatment conditions. For this reason, waste discharge requirements often include an effluent limit of 30 milligrams per liter for BOD. Total suspended solids, or TSS, is a constituent of concern in discharges to land, primarily because it can degrade soil permeability and clog soil pores. Additionally, total suspended solids can act as carriers for hazardous pollutants, such as pesticides and pathogens. They deplete oxygen during decomposition and create surface sludges that inhibit soil microbial activity. WDRs often include an effluent limit of 30 milligrams per liter for TSS. High concentrations of total nitrogen in wastewater discharges that leach into groundwater pose a threat to public health by causing drinking water toxicity. Total nitrogen in wastewater is mostly converted to nitrate in aerobic soils. Because nitrates are highly soluble, they easily leach into groundwater aquifers. If the groundwater is used for supply, elevated nitrate levels can cause blue baby syndrome in infants. WDRs often set a total nitrogen effluent limit of 10 milligrams per liter. High total dissolved solids result in elevated salt content that alters soil chemistry and can lead to toxic contamination, resulting in water supply and soil that is unusable. Wastewater treatment facilities regulated by WDRs include publicly owned treatment works, or POTWs, and smaller on-site wastewater treatment systems. The figure shows the locations of these facilities throughout our region, which includes the Coachella Valley, Riverside County, Imperial County, San Bernardino County, and even a small portion of San Diego County. Building on Fatima's introduction to traditional wastewater treatment processes, I will go into more detail regarding the treatment process, including preliminary treatment, which includes screening, grit removal, or grinding. Mechanical bar screens, grit chambers, or grinders are used during this process to remove or reduce the size of large solid objects. Primary treatment includes sedimentation, where wastewater is routed to a clarifier or holding tank, and heavier organic solids are allowed to settle to the bottom of the tank, and scum is typically scraped from the top. This process results in a reduction of BOD and TSS. Secondary treatment includes a biological process that promotes the growth and use of microorganisms to break down waste and remove dissolved and suspended organic matter. Some examples include activated sludge processes, including the use of anoxic zones to provide denitrification, rotating biological contactors, trickling filters, and membrane bioreactors. Membrane bioreactors combine biological treatment and membrane filtration into one treatment module or tank, and are a popular technology due to its high effluent quality, compact footprint, and expandability. Tertiary treatment or chemical treatment may include reverse osmosis, chlorination and dechlorination, or UV disinfection. Solids handling at some treatment facilities include sludge conveyance to digesters for further breakdown and generation of gas, such as methane. Sludge may also be dewatered with the use of centrifuges or belt presses before being sent to concrete-lined sludge drying beds, where the solids are dried and eventually hauled for disposal. Final effluent is routed to land facilities, discussed in the next slide, regulated by waste discharge requirements set by the land disposal unit. Some common examples of wastewater discharges to land include lined surface impoundments, which facilitate evaporation of wastewater, typically at a minimum. Treatment for solid separation precedes flow to surface impoundments. Unlined surface impoundments facilitate percolation and evaporation of treated wastewater and are frequently utilized in Region 7 due to availability of land, ideal soil characteristics, and higher than average evaporation rates. Seepage pits and leach fields are often used for subsurface disposal of treated wastewater and can be seen in the diagram. Seepage pits use less square footage as compared to leach fields and are constructed at a greater depth, while leach fields utilize a greater surface area and are constructed at much more shallow depths. Typically, when using leach fields or seepage pits, an area is required to be designated for 100% replacement. The monitoring and reporting programs are necessary to ensure compliance with waste discharge requirements. Typical monitoring requirements for wastewater treatment facilities with discharges to land include flow monitoring, which is typically required as many facilities have maximum flow limitations. For larger wastewater treatment facilities, plants, this is typically accomplished by flow meter reading or partial flow measurements. Constituents in the effluent discharge are regularly sampled and monitored to determine compliance with effluent limitations, such as BOD, TSS, total nitrogen, and TDS, as previously mentioned. Groundwater is regularly monitored to determine the impact of discharges to groundwater. Samples are taken from monitoring wells in the proximity of the discharge. New facilities or planned expansions of facilities may require new monitoring wells to be drilled and constructed. The condition of surface impoundments is required to be regularly monitored and includes conditions of berms or side slopes, liners, and topsoil of disposal ponds, assuring they are free of vegetation and overgrown shrubs. Typically, WDRs do not require bacteria or toxicity testing, where the NPDES program regularly requires these tests. The NPDES programs require these tests as they must consider the impact of discharges to aquatic life habitats that exist in surface waters. Reporting requirements may include annual reporting, quarterly, or monthly reporting, or all three. When noncompliance with effluent limitations occurs, the discharger is required to give notification and may be required to resample weekly or biweekly. Waste discharge requirements are issued for the duration of the discharge and do not contain an expiration date. Renewal or updates to waste discharge requirements are required when there are changes in facility operations or when there are planned expansions or upgrades to the facilities. A report of waste discharge is requested that characterizes the waste discharge and evaluates the treatment process, water balance, soils and geology, disposal system, groundwater, stormwater, and surface water. The WDR permit preparation and development process takes more than 4 months and involves review of technical information provided in the report of waste discharge and an evaluation of the potential impact of the discharge to surrounding groundwater quality. This concludes my presentation, and I will now answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great report, both. I mean, really, really good. The only, I just have a few questions. Like on slide three, you know, you mentioned the facilities. It'd be nice to see a one page with a list of them.
Okay.
You know, so we know which are the 17 and which are the 36.
Okay, perhaps we could number them and then have the title of that facility with that associated.
Yeah, because on one of the slides, mm-hmm. I could see them on the slide, mm-hmm. but this is slide 11. I can't read their names. I can see them on here, but I can't see them here.
We would be happy to provide that.
Okay, and then on slide 15, it sounds contradictory. You show the standard and say equivalent, which is 50% higher. How is that an equivalent? You know, like BOD, 30 to 45. Is that just regulations?
So what we are trying to say here is that explain that the secondary treatment standards are more stringent than the equivalent to secondary treatment standards. For example, for the secondary treatment standards, the monthly average will not the maximum is 30 milligrams per liter. But for this equivalent to secondary treatment standards, the maximum will be up to 45 milligrams per liter just because they are using different technologies. So the equivalent to secondary means they are less stringent criteria.
So,
because they are using like waste stabilization ponds and trickling filters and compared to the aeration basins for the secondary treatment standards.
So they're not meeting the secondary standards, but we're saying it's an equivalent.
Yeah, for waste ponds and trickling filters, they will not be able to meet the secondary treatment standards because of the technology they are using. So they are using old technology. So they are meeting the equivalent to secondary treatment standards, which is the 45
so
milligram.
So they're meeting the secondary standards when their facilities were built, and there have been, is that what you're saying? Now the secondary treatment standards have gotten more defined?
More stringent because they have advanced technology, yes.
Yeah, for member music, I think that secondary, we mentioned about like biological treatment, so a technology advance, so the aeration tank, those processes can treat to reach much better efficiency, so much better result. The old technology like trickling filter or pond, some facility already built there for a number of years, and they are waiting for fund to upgrade. If we don't have alternative standard, those facilities always will violate the secondary standard because their process is not capable to reach that.
So are you saying, though, if it's a brand new facility that's going to open January of 2027, they'd be held to the secondary
yes.
treatment and
yes.
they wouldn't be allowed to get to the equivalent?
Equivalent is gradually will phase out.
Okay. That makes sense. And then on slide 23, Here we say main, you know, it's, what's the difference between these two statements? You're saying you're going to maintain the existing, but minimize the contaminant. So if it's either you're going to do one
assimilative
capacity.
Well,
with minimizing the quantities of contaminants, so we set effluent discharge limits for specific contaminants. So with our limits being set, we are ensuring that there is no that we will maintain that water quality. So with us, I guess the second one addresses what we are actively doing in our unit by setting those limits so that it does not reach the groundwater basin.
Okay.
If that makes sense, by looking at the soil percolation rates and those sorts of things.
Yep, that makes perfect sense. Thank you. Once again, this is a great presentation. And I would just, it seems like you have all the data, but a listing of the facilities and like the WDRs that,
yes.
What is their current requirement? I mean, if it's an older facility, they're going to have an equivalent. If it's a newer facility, it'd be nice to have a one page summary of all that information.
Let me clarify. We're talking about secondary and equivalent to secondary. That's only applied to a MPDES facility. So for WDR, we follow the state regulation, which is state doesn't specify secondary or equivalent to secondary. But I think we'd be able to provide a list, kind of specify what kind of treatment process for a typical facility in a list.
Right. We could have two summaries, one for the NPDES and one for the facilities. Good job. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry, I have one more. I have some questions. You mentioned, so the NPDES permits do expire and do require renewal, and it sounds like the discharger submits, I guess, an application or a report to you, and then it takes at least 4 months to process that, and that the permit will automatically renew for, you know, some amount of time while we work on it. Do we find that is the interim between when they're acknowledging that they're going to need a permit extension sufficiently early enough to prevent the permit lapsing and going into that kind of like interim phase? Is that also dictated by Clean Water Act? Do we have any control over that? I guess my question is, do we need to be requiring notices of intent to renew earlier? Or are we are we keeping pace with the requests?
Yeah, so if you look at the first page of each permit, there is ROWD, like the discharge needs to submit by this date. It's usually 180 days before the permit expires where they submit their applications, and we try to reach out to them and give them all the forms where they need to submit the lab reports, the plans, and so on.
Board Member Satin, as long as the discharger is in compliance with the application period, the permit is administratively extended.
Right.
So if they do not satisfy that requirement, then that's a different road to travel down.
Understood. I guess my thinking here is that like if every permit is automatically extending to give folks time to reissue the permit, it seems like the initial permit term is too short, I guess. I don't know. It seems odd that my anecdotal observation is that we enter a lot of these, like the permit lapsed a year ago, we're working on, they're in compliance, so we're working on extending it. But that seems to be like a structural, an administrative structural problem that seems like.
It is. The five-year renewal period is informed by the federal code.
Sure.
And
okay.
The advantage of an administrative extension is that it does give us the time to fully develop the permit update without an overall limit that that overburdens our resources, our available staffing resources.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. I mean, it seems like it's working. It just seems odd to see all these things administratively renewed when we knew it expired a year ago or whatever it is. And I understand it's out of our control, but
virtually all MPDES permit receives an administrative extension that we process, and sometimes it takes an additional couple years.
Yeah, understood. Yep. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any additional questions?
I just want to note that, like,
compared to the other regional boards, we are basically at the top of the class when it comes to the MPDES permitting Treadmill.
And my intent here is not. Yeah.
You're the best in class, the creme de la creme. This region is so there is in many other regions an enormous MPDES permitting backlog, where I don't want to talk about specific other regions, but I'm thinking in one of mine where they're pretty much almost an entire permit length behind. And we, by comparison, I think, Kai, you said it was 88%, compliance.
Yes.
With that.
So we are renew our permit in time. So we have we keep our permit 88% renew in time. So look, we only have maybe one permit still in process. Compared to other region, we are the top.
So my question is, how many other regions have the same amount of MPDES that we do, or less than?
Well, we have enough to keep us busy, but you compare it to a coastal region, our share of land disposal permits relative to MPDES permits is probably it's probably roughly equivalent.
Yeah, obviously, those coastal region, they have a more MPDES permit than inland region. But you have to know the region 5, the Central Valley, is a large, large region. And compared to Lahontan region, we have a more facility compared to Lahontan region.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
For agenda item 10, the board will now hear a report from Executive Officer Michael Placencia.
Okay, good morning, Chair Perez, members of the board, members of the public. I am Michael Placencia, Executive Officer. Beginning in July, the regional boards and state water board have implemented the governor's executive order to have staff return to office. So beginning in July, we have our staff, with the exception of some exemptions and accommodations, coming to the office a minimum of 4 days a week. So if you stop by, you'll see that it's a little more busy around here as far as the bodies in the building. In response to the request from the board from the June meeting, we have posted a link to the Proposition 4 U.S.-Mexico Border Grant Program page on our website. As the board heard in June, this fund makes available $46 million for project proposals aimed at improving water quality in the Tijuana and New Rivers, including $3 million available for planning and research. The application period for this funding remains open until August 31st. Recently, the California State Legislature made a budget decision based on an updated budget change proposal that will be returning two positions to Region 7. So we look forward to proceeding with the that process, recruitment and finding two wonderful candidates here in the next few months. I'm unsure on when they'll open the recruitment period for us, but we can at least look forward to receiving two additional positions here in the next year. In June, Board Member Wright and I, along with several other regional board staff, attended a workshop presenting an update on the Coachella Valley Salt and Nutrient Management Plan. This process is intended to profile loading of salts and nutrients to the Mission Creek, Desert Hot Springs, and Indio subbasins, identify sources, and develop management zones for the long-term protection of groundwater in these basins. We remain engaged in this process, and we will bring an update on the progress of this effort before the board later in the year. Finally, I'd like to introduce our new intern, Alexis Sarmiento Ayala, to the board.
Hello.
Back there.
Welcome.
Alexis comes to us as an intern through our regional board's partnership with the Kankui Design Initiative, KDI. She joined our team at the end of June and will be with us until September. Alexis graduated from the University of Redlands in December of 2025. She has experience with local, global environmental research, water quality sampling, and mapping environmental quality data in ArcGIS. Some of her projects have included environmental field research in Joshua Tree National Park, mapping and water quality in Panama, and biological and geological research in Palau. She previously worked for the Audubon Salton Sea and Deserts Program as an outreach assistant and supported their quarterly bird surveys at the Salton Sea. Alexis is a fantastic addition to our office and will be gaining experience across all units during her internship. Please help me welcome her. Thank you. This concludes my report.
Thank you. Any questions?
I don't have any questions, but I just want to thank you, Michael, for putting these presentations together. I know the board tasked you with bringing us these presentations. They were very informative, very well put together. Thank you, staff. Fantastic job. Learned a lot in the process. So just want to say thank you and congratulate you and your team for successful presentations. Thank you.
I'll say ditto to that.
I agree.
Thank you all. Thank you both. You can look forward to us putting together additional study sessions to continue to ensure that the decision quality by this board is the best it can be. So,
got a question. Did you attend that July 9th Coachella Valley Regional Water Resiliency Plan? I was out of town. I didn't get to go, but how was it if you did?
Thank you for the prompt. I did attend the plan. It was hosted by Coachella Valley Water District, and it involved government, municipal, and water agencies from the Coachella Valley to address resilience in the face of a changing climate. The two principal focuses of that work group are addressing a demand. That is to say the supply of water in the valley, as well as conservation efforts to minimize demand to ensure that some of those water availabilities can get extended, and also implementation plans to address the potential for increasing severity of storm events. So stormwater management schemes and other technologies and updated regional and local ordinances to address stormwater specifically. That might include reducing the peak flows that are that flow to the Whitewater Channel, construction of low impact designs to maintain stormwater locally to where it drops on any facility areas, parcels that receive development, as well as mitigating pollution as a consequence of that effort to maintain stormwater, localized to those infiltration apparatus.
Is there going to be more of these, or?
Well, I think it's at this point it's a very very high level effort. There certainly will be a few clear considerations the cities are looking at, as we mentioned, the efforts to continue conservation. But in addition to that, and with the state support, we will be entering into the Proposition 4 stormwater guidelines for grants here soon enough. The regional board will be engaged in providing comment on developing those guidelines. Those guidelines are intended to provide multiple benefits. So that was a component of the discussion we had at the resiliency meeting. And your question, are these things ongoing? Absolutely. I think there's been a lot of discussion regarding the Super El Nino that's developing in the Pacific. Yeah. We'll see how that impacts us through the remainder of the summer and going into the fall and winter. But it can be anticipated that we'll be having a greater volume and greater severity storms here in the coming year. At least that's what's anticipated.
That's what I'm hearing about October through December or something like that of this year. We might have some heavy storms. That we might have more stormwater runoff than we usually have.
Yeah, those of us familiar with reliance on surface flows for stormwater are familiar also with occasionally the boulevards and avenues of this valley being taken out of service as they get deposition of sediment or they get undermined or overtopped or what have you. And so I think that's an increasing focus. The challenge, of course, is the valley is pretty level. So it's how do you design a stormwater conveyance that that is cost-effective and also addresses the severity and of these torrential downpours.
One more comment. I've told you this before, but I'll tell you again. In your update, I still can't open that one about what is it? Cleanup, oh. Site cleanup. The attachment. I don't know why I can't do it on any of my devices, and I'm okay with all the rest of them. I just still don't understand why. That's the one that's actually has all capitals letters in it. It's different looking on my than the other ones.
Board Member Wright, we will.
And if you tell me maybe if it's somewhere on our website, I'd try to look for it on the website to see it, but.
Sure, we'll find another way to post the to collect and present the site cleanup work notices to the board.
Okay, yeah, they're nice to read. Thank you.
Thank you.
They're good.
Thank you, Michael. Okay, we now move to agenda item 11, board member comments and suggestions for future agenda items. Do any of the board members have anything they wish to discuss?
I have a question for our attorney.
Yes.
When a board member requests a information-only non-action item, you know, for the future, is it possible for them to meet with the executive officer and review it before it gets presented to the entire board, just so we can assure that everything that they're asking for is presented, or is that something we cannot do?
As long as there is less than a quorum of you in that as long as there's less than a quorum of you in that pre-meeting, you're absolutely fine.
Oh, that's okay?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Just, you guys can't have a quorum of the board members.
No, like, for instance, I requested the wastewater. So what he's saying is I could have met with Michael and gone over through the presentation to see that it answered all my questions before it was presented mm-hmm. to the board.
Or alternatively, we love information items. We could have also met privately to discuss. And so if you just wanted an individual board member briefing, we can provide that too. Right. Many solutions.
Okay. Thank you.
And board member Music, I did make a note of some of your questions here at the end, and I'll be providing a list of facilities, WDR's current requirements, and other information in a follow-up briefing to the board.
Right. And I think another future agenda item, but out in the future, not immediately, is this whole state water project and access to Region 7. I know right now there's no access to state water.
The board will be hearing more on this at an information item this calendar year, so I appreciate you bringing that up. In addition to that, there are other salt and nutrient management considerations that will be workshopped to the board for direction as well here coming up. So I appreciate you bringing that up, and we'll be addressing that with you.
And I'd like to thank staff for excellent presentations today.
Got another comment. I got a comment on the salt nutrient management plan update. It was just really refreshing to see on a slide that was up there all of the data that we've collected, all the different water districts and whomever collected from Region 7, mostly Coachella Valley. It was just wonderful to see it all put together. On one page like that, it was like, wow, okay. And then so you can see your data gaps And actually, I think just about all the water districts were very they gave all the data that they have into this, which was the first time that I can ever remember that they all were willing to give it out and look at it all in a one regional event. So anyway, I think they're doing a good job. The salt nutrient management plan. I was happy to see that Michael and their consultant that they've all hired to do this plan. They got together that day, and so I think they're going to work together real good. And Michael said you were going to stay updated on the plan and what's going on there. So thank you.
Thank you. Any other board members?
I'm just wanted to echo that. To the other board members, the Salton Sea Summit dates have been shared to be October 16 and 17. That's a Friday and a Saturday, and I will be attending. Just letting you know. But the RZP hasn't gone out. Just wondering, y'all seen that?
Any future items that anyone wants to discuss? All right, thank you. And I did want to also mention I really appreciated the presentations. Very detailed. I love the images and the graphs and everything. I'm a visual person. Really appreciate that. Thank you. The next item is Chair's report. I just wanted to remind everyone that the Healthy Desert, Healthy You registration for the annual summit is now open. So I think it's first come, first. I'm not sure. I'm not sure of the limitation, but I already registered. Looking forward to it again. Okay. For the Desert Healthy District, yeah. Thank you. And are there any items, Council, for closed session?
No items today.
Okay. The next meeting is scheduled for September 8th. At 10 a.m. and here at the City of Palm Desert, Riverside County. You want to make a comment? Any comments?
No.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Meeting is adjourned.